Yeah, so the idea that she was pregnant with her boyfriend's baby or with the coach's baby?
Huh?
How like ridiculous is this going to become? We got to make it a soap opera. Does she have an evil twin who's going to show up and try to take her place next? Pretend to be her? Like, oh, Mora's back. No, I'm not Mora.
Welcome back. I'm Erin.
And I'm Ethan.
In this episode, we're going to discuss the second episode of the Oxygen series, The Disappearance of Mora Murray. I think it was a great episode and went a long way toward dispelling some of the rumors that have lingered for a long time. The episode featured author James Renner and outlined the basis for his theory that after finding out she was pregnant and in fear of her boyfriend Bill, Mora fled to escape her life and start a new one north of the border in Canada. Because we devote a large portion of the episode to Renner, I want to emphasize that this is not an attack on him personally. It's a critique of the assumptions underlying his theory that were highlighted in the episode, and some of the methods he appeared to employ during his process of crafting the book. There was a lot of content in episode 2, and we couldn't cover everything, but of the topics we do cover, they include the interview with Erin, the woman from Mora's nursing program, the state of Mora's dorm room, Renner's lighthouse theory, and a breakdown of who was reportedly watching the scene and when. And finally, we talk a little bit about Kate and Bill. We set it up by playing a clip from the show to introduce each topic and then jump right into our discussion. As always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions, clarifications, or criticism. Our contact information is in the show notes, or you can find it at the107degree.com.
So there's a lot of speculation that Mora might have been pregnant when she left.
The police think she was pregnant. They had searched her computer and found all these searches relating to the effects of drinking on a baby.
But it was probably because we were in maternity class.
Interesting.
We had a maternity assignment. So what we had done, as our clinical instructor had advised us to do, was to look up clinical terms and then email them to each other.
And that's why she was Googling those terms and sharing
them
with
you. Right, we were all Googling maternity terms. And right before she had left, she had done her homework assignment. Like, it was like the night before that she had sent it.
Mora emailed her homework at 3:32 a.m. on February 9th, the very morning she disappeared. If Mora's plan was to run away, the contents in her car could give us some clues.
The thing that stands out to me is there's a pack of birth control in the car.
It's interesting.
Four pills missing.
Finding birth control in her car isn't consistent with Renner's theory that she was pregnant.
The first thing I thought was pretty interesting was the interview with Erin, who was the nursing student that Mora had borrowed scrubs from the week before and returned the day that she left, the day that she disappeared. And a couple of things that she said were interesting. First of all, Erin said she emailed her homework on February 9th at 3:32 a.m. So, I mean, this is just my opinion, but it almost rules out entirely the possibility both that she was going to commit suicide and that she was running away from her life.
Yeah.
There's just no reason that the last thing that you do before taking off forever is your homework in a program that you don't intend to return to.
It makes those theories, to me, like a crazy stretch. There's really no other corroborating evidence that couldn't be explained in other better ways.
Yes,
so you're just reaching at this point if you're going with the suicide or the leaping forever theory.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And when I say suicide, I mean that she intended to. It's still possible,
sure,
theoretically, that she wandered away from the car. But if you're doing your homework and you're going through the trouble of sending it 3:30 in the morning, you care about the short-term future.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Which everything about her personality seems to suggest that she would have. I mean, she was a high performer,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, she was going through a rough time, but I just imagine her thought process, and she's like, this is too much, I have to get out of here, but I can't let this fall apart, because then I'll have even more problems when I come back, so I have to keep trying, I have to keep doing my homework, I have to let my professors know where I'm going, you know, that I'm coming back. I have to do these things, because she was a responsible person at heart who was having trouble. So to me, that's very consistent with what we know about her, and it makes a lot of sense.
That, and she didn't miss work on Sunday, even after getting in a car accident. She still managed to get to work at the art gallery. So there's nothing to indicate that she was not concerned about the immediate future.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was pretty interesting. The other thing that she said was in relation to the homework assignment that they had been working on and how they had to Google terms about maternity and why that might be the reason that she had Googled things about maternity and alcohol.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
It does. And I mean, to me, just the fact that she's a nursing student is plenty of explanation for why she'd be Googling.
A nursing student in a maternity class.
And then on top of it, Aaron says that they were specifically instructed to look up terms and email them to each other and discuss them amongst themselves. I mean, that's easily the most plausible explanation, more so than that she was pregnant.
Yeah, even if fetal alcohol syndrome wasn't on her list of terms, you can see how you just start going down this Google rabbit hole and clicking things and looking other things up that come to your mind. Like, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree. It's not definitive that that's what her Google searches were about, but given that we don't even know specifically what they were and what the context was, what dates they were on, you know, the police would have all this information, we don't, but you know, we don't have enough information to say that it, you know, it means that she was pregnant when we have an equally plausible theory that it was, you know, for the class. So,
and on the subject, actually, one of the items in the car that they showed on episode 2 was that she had birth control pills with 4 pills missing.
Yeah, so she had birth control and she was taking it.
Well, of course it's possible she had stopped taking them at some point.
Right. Can't say for sure, but it's another piece of evidence against pregnancy.
Yes, just based on those things alone, those couple pieces of information. She had birth control pills, she was taking a maternity class, and the assignment that she was working on was to Google terms related to maternity. I think there's far more evidence suggesting that she was not pregnant than that she was.
Yeah, I would agree. Certainly, I wouldn't base any kind of larger theory or hinge it on her being pregnant, or say, you know, she was probably pregnant and that means this, you know, it's a leap. Just to touch on this, Renner also says that the police think that she was pregnant, or that someone in the police thinks she's pregnant or something. You know, again, we have no idea who said that, when they said it, what the context was. You know, we have Renner's word that that's what they believe.
Yeah, so in his book, he actually refers to retired Lieutenant Scorenza, who had worked on her case.
Okay.
In the early years. I think he retired in 2009. But in the book, and in anything written, all he says is that Scorenza thinks she might have been pregnant.
Ah, yes.
Which, first of all, he does not speak for the police.
Right.
But secondly, sure, she might have been.
Yeah, that's such a weak statement. Any woman might be pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between somebody saying she could have been or she might have been, and the police believe, the police think. I've put out a request, actually, to confirm the veracity of that statement, and I'll obviously interject if there's an update on that, but I don't think that the police have given any privileged information about what their theories are to anyone.
Yeah, that's also the sort of thing where if you just imagine how this case was unfolding as the police were investigating, they look at her computer, at her search history, they pull this up and they think, oh, wow, look at this. Maybe she was pregnant. Let's follow that lead. And so there's a theory of the case at some point where she was pregnant. That makes total sense that there would be. But that doesn't mean that they actually ultimately believe that she was pregnant. And so I can imagine someone later on saying, yeah, she might have been pregnant, because they're aware that that was a theory at one point. They might also be aware that there are alternative explanations, and you could still say she might have been pregnant based on that information. So to me, it's not compelling at all, the argument not that she's pregnant.
She had packed her room. Everything was in boxes. On top of the boxes was an email from Bill, her boyfriend, in which he's talking about how he cheated on her. That's a message. So long. Here's why I'm leaving. I think I've come to the answer. She was running away.
Another thing that they talked about in the episode that I've been critical of as well is the idea that her dorm room had been completely packed up, as if she were packing up her life. And they pointed to the fact that it was the beginning of the semester, and it's possible, and I think quite likely, that she had not yet unpacked.
Yep.
And, well, you might say, but she lived in the same room the semester before. So why would she have things in boxes? But the thing about UMass in particular is that you cannot enter the dorms during winter session. They don't allow you to come in. You have to actually turn in your key. At least when I was there in 2004 and as late as 2007, you had to turn in your key and the RA would inspect your room and make sure you didn't have even things like the wrong kind of tape or the wrong kind of adhesive on the walls would be a point against you if the RA caught it. People did it all the time, but they would just take that stuff down before they left, right?
Right.
So you essentially did pack up because people would be going in through the dorms and cleaning. And if you're at all concerned about your stuff.
Yep.
So I would essentially pack up my entire room almost and only leave a couple of things there and then unpack when I got back.
Yep. Makes sense.
Yeah. That's actually how you let the university know that you're back on campus and you're here for the semester is by checking in and getting your key. At least it was then. I believe it's done online now, like everything else.
Right.
But at the time, the way that you let the university know that you were present was by checking in and getting your key back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a million reasons why she might not have unpacked yet.
Yeah, from what I recall, the statement was that some of her stuff was in boxes.
True.
Some people say her whole room was packed. I haven't seen that other than people on the internet saying that. From what I've seen, some of her stuff was in boxes.
Right, and actually on the Missing Maura Murray episode 27, when they put this question to the state police, their exact words, I believe, were, "Nothing was in disarray, and some boxes appeared to be packed."
Mm-hmm.
Some boxes appeared to be packed. That's not a very strong statement.
Right.
So whether you think she had packed or had not yet unpacked is just a matter of what assumptions you're making when you look at that particular piece of information.
Yep.
And I just think that early on, people didn't realize what UMass was like.
Yeah, the police wouldn't have any reason to understand that. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, the other thing is it wasn't the end of ad drop and she lived in a freshman dorm. So she might not have even wanted to stay there. She could have been looking for a room change. She could have been looking to live off campus or she could have gotten a roommate.
Mm-hmm. She could have made housing changes.
Yeah.
At that point in the year. Yeah. All that coupled with the fact that she didn't take it with her. It's like, well, what was the purpose of packing up her life if she was going to leave it in the room? If you're trying to come up with some theory where she was, where the fact that her boxes were packed is relevant to where she was going, how do you connect that? How do you say, well, she was packing her stuff because she was planning to leave forever, but she didn't take it. So how does that follow? It doesn't make any sense. That never made any sense to me. So now looking at the possibility that she just never unpacked it, that makes sense. That theory makes sense. The theory that she was packing it and didn't take it with her, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. Now, people that ascribe to the suicide theory would say that this is a behavior that sometimes suicidal people engage in. They'll pack things up for their family.
Sure, they want their life to be in order.
Right.
For the suicide theory, it makes some kind of sense. You can see how they connected those dots together.
Mm-hmm. But for the runaway theory, it just makes no sense.
Yeah, to me, I don't understand that.
And then one of the other things that Renner mentioned actually about the state of her room was that there was this note.
Right. It's an email, right? It was an email printout.
It was a printed email from her boyfriend. He interprets this as a cryptic goodbye note, goodbye letter.
Mm-hmm. I assume he interprets it that way because he's trying to come up with a reason why it's there. He's assuming it's deliberate placement. It could have just been random. You know, it doesn't have to be deliberate. You know, Renner thinks of it as a note. It's some kind of signal or symbol of what she's doing. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't she just write a note?
Or if it was like specifically intended for Bill, why not put it in an envelope and write to Bill, like it, or address it in some obvious way?
Yeah. Why would she make it deliberately cryptic?
And that would have to assume that Bill was going to be the one to walk into her dorm and see it. Why would she think that? How would she even think that it would get to
him? I don't even understand what the idea behind the message being a note is. Because, like, yeah, that's one possibility. Or is it like they think whoever finds it will read it and be like, oh, she's left forever because of this email about this guy who I guess is her boyfriend?
Mm-hmm.
What is the idea there that she would have in leaving it as to what it means to the person who's picking it up?
Which would likely not be her boyfriend, given that he was living in Oklahoma.
Right. So I just don't understand what people who subscribe to this theory think it specifically means. It almost seems like they're saying, well, yeah, it was about her boyfriend and she was upset about it and it's a message. Like, that's enough to explain it. I'm like, that's not, I don't know. I still don't understand. I don't understand right. that message. How is it an explanation? It's not.
No, it's just a part of her personal life that she left with her personal belongings in her dorm room. Like, it's really not that out of the ordinary when you think about it.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you think about, like, well, what's sitting on my desk? You know, what's in my room? What was in my dorm room?
Yeah, I don't really think that holds a lot of water. I certainly don't think it's a suicide note either, which is also another theory that's been proposed. But again, in episode 27 of the Missing Maura Murray podcast, they essentially disprove this theory because the state police said that they've recovered no apparent suicide note.
Right, so the police don't believe it's suicide note. That's not their interpretation.
Right, so I think it was just an email that was printed and that she left there. And unfortunately, because we have such little information, anything is going to seem relevant.
Look, it's certainly a clue because, you know, it's relevant to what she's thinking about and what she's going through in her life.
That's true.
And it's relevant to what the state of her relationship is. It's not definitive. It doesn't give us a clear picture of what's going on, but it does give you some information. But to extrapolate that the placement of the note was a message, to me, that's a step too far. That's way too far.
Way too far.
Yeah.
We also don't know when it was from. We're assuming that it was an email exchange that had occurred in the recent past, but it could have been from months or years ago.
Yeah.
We have absolutely no idea. So I don't think that we can infer anything about the note. Certainly not that it's a cryptic goodbye message, in my opinion.
I don't think that was
a huge leap.
Yep.
I believe there's two possibilities after that point. One, she got into a vehicle of a stranger. Or two, somebody that she knew picked her up. Well, a stranger had already offered her a ride. Butch Atwood came by in his school bus and said, "Can I give you a ride? I live right here."
I just asked her how she was. She said she was shaken up. I couldn't see any blood on her face. I says, okay, I'm gonna go call the police.
She said, no, I called AAA. He knew that was a lie because you can't get cell phone service up there. Also, take into account that you've got Faith Westman watching the scene across the street. You've got John Merritt watching. You've got the Atwoods watching. So I picture three different lighthouses, these three witnesses that are watching the scene, and you've got this beam of light that passes over the accident scene. Nobody's watching the whole time, but people are looking back and forth. So that only gives more very small windows in which to disappear. Like, we're talking 15 to 20 seconds. What's more probable? That she got into a car of a stranger? Well, if it was a stranger, they'd have to come up and there'd be a conversation. Hey, what happened? Are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Would you like a ride? Yes, let me get some things, yada, yada, yada.
Someone would have seen that.
Somebody would have seen that. So what you're left with is the likelihood that the person that picked her up was somebody she knew. Well, if somebody she knew came by to pick her up, that interaction could be very quick. They could come up, she could hop in, they could be on their way.
Renner says that the Westmans, Atwoods, and Marats were watching the scene, sort of off and on as though they were lighthouses, I believe it was his analogy.
Yeah, basically creating the impression that these people are regularly checking back and would be in such a way that there'd be almost continuous coverage of someone looking at the scene. That's the impression he created, where you don't have a few seconds here or there where the light, quote unquote, wasn't sweeping you, where you weren't being watched by a pair of eyes.
Right. And this is in the context of his argument that she would not take a ride from a stranger because she hadn't taken help from Butch Atwood.
Right.
When he offered it. So therefore, he concludes that she was unwilling to accept help from any stranger at all.
So he makes a lot of assumptions here. He's making an assumption that she only possibly could have gotten into a car voluntarily with someone who drove up to her, and that it wouldn't have been a stranger. So these are two very important assumptions. And he's basing, I guess, the assumption that it was voluntary on the fact that there was so little time that there couldn't have been like a struggle or anything. It must have happened like immediately where there was, you know, she just climbed in.
Right.
So, yeah. So let's talk about those assumptions.
So first, the assumption that because she refused help from Atwood, she would refuse help from all strangers. And the thing that immediately stands out to me is, well, she had just gotten into the accident. Just because she wanted to perhaps try to figure out a way to handle it by herself first before, you know, involving other people.
You know, he says, well, she wasn't willing to accept help from Atwood. Well, come on. Now, you're a 21-year-old person. Do you want help from a stranger? No. You want to figure it out. You want to get out of that situation. You don't want to add another crazy variable to your crazy night.
Right. You don't want to walk into a situation that could be ultimately very uncomfortable. A man that she doesn't know. And has no reason to trust.
Who his own wife described as potentially imposing in appearance, by the way, and who expressed understanding that she wouldn't want to, you know, accept help from him. And when you haven't even had a chance to try to fix the situation.
Right. You haven't exhausted the options that you believe that you have already.
Yeah.
So yeah, it makes perfect sense that she would perhaps reject his offer.
Yeah. And then change her mind later on.
Right. And then ultimately decide that, well, actually, I think I probably need some assistance.
I mean, what we're really saying here is people are allowed to change their minds when the conditions change.
Right.
Upon evaluating new information, or even for no reason at all, by the way. People can change their minds after a couple minutes, even if nothing has materially changed in their situation. She didn't like the look of the car. She thought it was weird that a bus pulled up. Could be anything. Who knows what's going through your head at that point?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I don't know if you said it in this particular episode, but to say that she's a liar because she said that she called AAA, she might just be polite.
Yep.
It might have just been something she said to be polite because she didn't want to say, I don't go into houses of strange men that I don't know if I don't absolutely have to.
Yeah, so the easier way to diffuse that situation is just say,
Yeah, to say that you're all set and that it's being handled.
I think sometimes that comes up also in the context of the claim that she refused or she begged him not to call the police, because that line came up somewhere. Someone said that. I don't remember who.
Yeah, that's sort of another instance of the telephone over the years. I think I have this exact quote somewhere. I'll tell you exactly what she said. So he's made two statements that I'm aware of where he's being directly quoted. This is the first one. It's from the Caledonian Record on February 20th.
Okay.
He says, I saw no blood. She was cold and she was shivering. I told her I was going to call the police. Murray, according to Atwood, told him not to because she had already called AAA. So from that, it's like she begged him not to call police. Like, that's what it's turned into over the years.
Yeah. That's the whole thing, is like, was she specifically trying to avoid the police? And, you know, from the one way the statement is phrased, it looks like she is. But if you phrase it a little differently, it's more like she just wants this guy to go away.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I think that's what she was probably trying to accomplish when she said that she had called AAA.
Yeah. And the fact is, you know, all we know is that he ultimately went and did call the police anyway, but we don't know exactly what he said.
Yeah. So one of the things I thought was interesting in the Maura is Missing piece of the Whitman Hansen Express did is that they actually address this. It's really great. It's like 30 pages, pretty in-depth piece of writing about the case. But Mary Beth Conway, the author, says, Atwood stepped out of his bus and asked Maura if she wanted him to call the police. Maura told him not to bother, saying that she had already called AAA, Atwood said. So here he's saying she told him not to bother. That's very different from what the New Hampshire State Police synopsis released by Lieutenant Scorenza said. And in this article, it states that. It says, the synopsis painted a different view of the encounter. Quote, when the passerby stated that he was going to call local law enforcement to come assist, Moore pleaded with him not to call the police. That's kind of suspicious.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I don't... This is not the episode to, like, go down that road, but... But, yeah, I don't think that that's true. It's just like the alcohol. Police are saying one thing, and Atwood is saying a completely different thing.
Yeah. Like, the police wanted to look like she was trying to avoid contact with the police. How are we supposed to find her? She was trying her hardest not to contact the police in any way.
Yeah.
Don't blame us for not finding her.
Right. So this wasn't even the point I was trying to make, but it is interesting that their account seems to differ substantially from every statement that I've read that Atwood has said himself. Okay, so Renner, I understand the image that he's trying to paint in our heads, and I understand why that makes that might make sense to him. But just going by the statements of the individuals, Westman, just take Westman first. She reported that when the bus showed up, she stopped looking at the scene. She looked away because Atwood had shown up, right? And her view was probably obstructed by the bus.
Right, so she walks away, she can't see anything.
Yeah, so she's not looking at the scene.
From the period where that's in question, she's not watching. So that lighthouse is not on.
Right.
There's one.
And then there were the Merritts, or the Marats. According to the Whitman Hansen Express article, from their kitchen, they could see a car down the road with his hazard lights flashing and someone walking around the car. And they also reported seeing Butch show up. They don't say how long that they continued watching the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But in Renner's book, he quotes John Marat as having said, "I saw her get out and walk around the car. When I looked out again, the police were there." To me, that suggests that he's not watching the scene the entire time.
No.
Not even most of the time. That's my interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's only there at the beginning and the end, really. He's only looking at the start and end of the time window. So again, not helpful for seeing anything during the period in question.
Right. So assume for a second that she refused Butch's help because she thinks that she can perhaps run up the street and get a signal and handle it herself without having to engage with strangers and go into their homes in the middle of nowhere. Butch leaves. She does something in her trunk, locks the car, grabs her bag, runs up the street toward Butch's house, like in that easterly direction. He's not looking at the scene because he just got home and he's in the house doing whatever he's doing. He's finding the phone. He's talking to his wife. He's doing whatever else you do when you first arrive home from work and walk into the house.
Yeah, and there's no specific information that said he was watching the scene.
Right.
There's no statement from him saying, "I was looking the whole time." I mean, and it's interesting. Renner makes it seem like he has information that suggests that these people were watching continuously, and he doesn't.
If anything, it's the opposite, because Atwood says he's calling the police, right? That's going to take some time.
Yep.
There's no reason to think that he has a cordless phone.
We actually know that it took him a little while because he couldn't get through to the Haverhill police at first. So he ends up going to, was it Hanover? And then they have to transfer him. So it's probably a fairly lengthy call.
Yeah, longer than you might expect or think.
Yeah.
And so he's, I would say, probably not looking at the scene for at least a couple of minutes.
At least, yeah.
The Westmans state very specifically that when Atwood showed up, she looked away.
Yeah, so she's probably not looking at the scene.
So she's not looking at the scene. And then Marat, who says that he saw her walking around the car, he looked up again, and the police were there. So to me, that says he also wasn't looking at the scene.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on when he saw her get out of the car. When was that? Was that before Atwood showed up, or was that after Atwood showed up? It was after. It could have been at any time.
He could have seen her get out of the car and walk around while Atwood was there, because unlike Westman, whose view would have been obstructed by the bus, it's possible Marat could actually see both the car and Maura and Atwood, because he was on the east side of the road.
Yeah, so she and the car would have been between him and the bus.
Mm-hmm. So it's very possible that he saw her get out while Atwood was there.
Yeah, at the most, he saw someone walking around the car one time at some point after, but certainly not that he was constantly checking for 7 to 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, so the idea that there was almost constant surveillance of the scene, I don't know if I'm sold on that idea.
I don't think there's any good evidence that there was.
No, I don't think so either. And just going along with the theory that she talks to Atwood, she decides that I'm going to have to leave the car here for a minute, run up the road and try to get a signal and to call AAA. It's very possible that nobody saw her do that in the dark when there's no streetlights. Also, even if they did continue watching the scene, she's not at it anymore. So what difference does it make?
Right.
All she had to do was just get out of their view, which she could have done in 15, 20 seconds.
Right. Now, I will say about that is from what the dogs picked up, the path that she traveled, it was just from her car to 100 feet up the road, which was near Atwood's house, was it not?
Yes, and it also would have been essentially in front of the Marat's house as well.
Right, so she was moving from one place where they could see her to another place where they would have been able to see her. So if they were looking, you would think they would have seen her based on that. I mean, it could be that there was no lights, you know, there was no light, and so they wouldn't have noticed her traversing that distance or noticed another car there. That's where I think, like, they probably would have probably noticed, you know, if there was something happening, if they were looking between the accident site and their houses.
I agree. I think that if something occurred, they probably would have seen that in front of
if they were looking.
Or yeah. heard it or something. But if she were to get far enough east to the point where they looked out the window and she was outside the range of their peripheral vision and they were looking in one direction and had no reason to think that they should be looking in the opposite direction, then all she would have to do is get a little bit further down the road for them to be completely unaware and perhaps oblivious to what was occurring.
You know, let's say the lighthouses was a thing. We really don't think it was, but suppose there wasn't that much time. Is it possible for her to have been abducted in a small window of time? I think it is. I think it's possible for her to have been abducted by someone in a car in less than a minute, certainly.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be a long, drawn-out affair. I think people have this idea that, like, well, no one would just take me. I would fight. I would resist them. Which, of course, you want to believe that you somehow know that a stranger who approaches you is going to attack you, and so you would fight back. But you don't know that. You wouldn't assume that a person is out to get you, because most people aren't. You might be wary, but if someone approaches you and they seem friendly, your guard might be down, you might not know what to do, you might freeze, and if they get close enough, it can be over real quick, your ability to resist.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that women are such targets sometimes is because they, I'm making an assumption here, gendered assumption.
Well, you are a woman, so you have a little bit of authority on the matter.
But I think there's less of a willingness to upset or offend anyone, even if it's a complete stranger. So even if your gut was telling you, I am creeped out and this person's getting closer to me and I do have an impulse to run, you might not, just because it seems so extreme. And if you're not completely sure, it seems pretty extreme to just bolt to somebody who is ostensibly offering help.
Yeah, because then that'll be like, why did you run? Yeah.
Could be an objectively weird thing to do if you're wrong. And so, I mean, Ted Bundy, one of the reasons he was so successful is because he would make himself look pathetic wearing a, you know, a sling or something, like a cast on his arm, and ask for help from women. And even when they probably had some hesitation, they would help him out anyway, to the point where they would get in his car because they didn't want to offend somebody unnecessarily. So yeah, I absolutely think that that could have happened, that somebody could have approached, even gotten out of the car and seemed innocuous and was just trying to make it seem like they were just trying to talk to her.
Taking out their cell phone. Hey, do you need me to call someone? I think I got a signal here. And just, you know, taking a step closer, a step closer, a step closer, you know. I don't necessarily think that's what happened or that it went down that way. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem impossible.
Outside the realm of possibility at all.
It doesn't seem like something that should be discounted as like, no, someone, she must have gotten into someone's car. Someone pulled up and convinced her to get in their car. I don't see how you have to draw that conclusion at all.
Yeah, I agree. And that could definitely happen in less than a minute.
Yeah. And we had several minutes within which it could have happened.
Yeah. Or perhaps she did get willingly into a car of a bad person, you know, might have looked a little more innocent than Atwood.
Yeah, he might have been a clean-cut guy.
A younger person. Looks are very deceiving.
A couple?
Yeah.
It would not be the first time that a couple of people were involved in someone disappearing, being abducted.
It would not be the first time in New Hampshire that a couple was involved in a random abduction of a woman. So that's definitely possible. It's also possible she did get in willingly, and that takes like 10 seconds for a conversation to occur in which someone pulls over and says, hey, can I offer you some help? I can drive you to the closest gas station. Yep. It's just up the road. She says, yeah, sure, and hops in the car. That takes 15, 20 seconds.
Yep.
Maybe not even.
And it might have even seemed safer than Butch Atwood's, you know, whatever Butch Atwood was suggesting.
Than going into the home.
Going into a house, yeah.
If given two alternatives, I think I'd rather get in a car than go into somebody's home. Because, like, a car, theoretically, you have some ability to escape the situation, possibly. Whereas, like, the home, you just...
Once you're in it.
You're in very vulnerable.
Yeah, that's very plausible to me. It's certainly, there's no way to get from like, well, maybe there wasn't a lot of time for something to happen, to there must have been a tandem car of people that she knew, because that's the only way she would have gotten into a car that fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's another leap.
It's a huge leap.
Which is unsubstantiated by a reasonable analysis of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And if that's the only evidence for a tandem car, which it really, I mean, it's that's only compelling if you already have reason to think that there's another car, which you don't.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if you believe that somebody's going to be arriving momentarily to pick you up anyway, why do you get out and run 100 yards?
Yeah. Why is the tandem car that far behind in the first place? You know, like...
Or I believe he thinks it was ahead.
Ahead?
I think so, which makes less sense.
How does it know to come back?
I don't know. Maybe, like, it's on a stretch of road and it doesn't... It no longer sees her.
Her headlights, so they get worried and they turn around. I mean, I guess it's possible.
Or they think she's lost, maybe. Maybe she lost the trail, or she was following somebody and didn't perhaps know exactly where she was going, so.
That could have happened.
Yeah, it's not outside the realm of possibility. It's just certainly not the only
explanation.
Possibility.
Yeah.
And the fact that we have absolutely no idea who this person or people were that she was with.
Yeah, and they've kept it secret all these years, whoever they are.
Yeah, I'm less willing to buy that than it was a random person.
If I was going to believe it, I certainly wouldn't believe it was Kate.
No.
And all I know is that Kate has lied to me several times, you know, about the party. So Kate's lying to me, and I'm trying to figure out why.
There's some deception going on there. And again, you gotta ask why, and what it has to do with Maura's disappearance.
She's lying when she could just easily tell the truth.
And she said something weird to me once. It was an email. I know you'd really like the names of people that were at that party. It's just not gonna happen. I don't remember, and I couldn't help them then. And furthermore, I didn't see many of them ever again. Or something along that line. And it was a weird slip up because who from that party did you see again?
You talk to Kate, you know? And she'll say, oh geez, it's been so many years, I don't remember anybody at that party. So really, you don't remember a single, just a first name? No, sorry, why?
Why would one of Maura's closest friends not offer enough information to help? Could she be hiding something?
So the only thing I want to say about Kate is that I think she's already given the answer to that, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know anything.
Yeah. But you can see someone coming new to the case.
Sure.
You know, to her, it's this case is just beginning. Why wouldn't someone want to talk to me? And it's like, no, it's not just beginning.
Right. Right. And so I understand why they said it. And in fairness, they do make an effort to reach out to her. And at least from... them demonstrating that they didn't seem to make contact, it would seem that they did not ever hear from her. Mm-hmm. So I could see how that might be considered suspicious. I just think it's a little bit unfair not to provide the context of, well, she had been talking to journalists early on. She's quoted in many news articles, including like the 17 article that came out pretty early on after the disappearance, and she had spoken to police, which is the important thing.
Yeah, that's really a key point. Like, she's already talked to people, you know.
Mm-hmm. And she met with James Renner.
Yep.
And Renner has made the claim that she's withholding things to police, but he has nothing to back that up and no privileged knowledge of what the police knows or any of the witness interviews that they've had or anything else. So I find that highly, highly suspect.
Has he said what he thinks she's holding back?
Well, I think to him, it's the people at the party.
He might have information that the police don't know who was at the party. I mean, that's the only thing I think where he would have reason to think that she didn't tell the police, if he thinks that the police don't know either for some reason.
He has not stated that.
Okay.
So I don't believe that that's the case.
Interesting.
I don't think that they would tell him if they knew who was at the
party. I would hope not.
Especially given the civil lawsuit that occurred, where they would not divulge any piece of information. Not to her father, not to anyone. But they're going to tell a journalist? Something isn't right there.
Yeah.
The fact that we're even calling it a party, that in itself is kind of a construction of which the origins are somewhat unknown.
What is a party, you know, mm-hmm. in a college dorm? Party is very frequently 4 or 5 people sitting around drinking. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you leave your door open and people wander down and you invite them in, and sometimes you don't. I mean, it could be anything.
It couldn't have been too big because those dorm rooms were very tiny. A standing room only could literally be five people. Again, this was Sarah Alfieri's party, mm-hmm. and Sarah and Kate had no connection other than through Maura. So they were not independently, they were not friends.
Okay.
From completely different sort of circles. Kate was on the track team, and Sarah was I believe an art major and worked at her with the art gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Sarah's party, or Sarah's dorm room. So it could have been all Sarah's friends, and Kate may legitimately not remember the names of the people at the party.
If she didn't know who they were.
Yeah. That's not actually outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah. It's a big campus, UMass is.
Quite a big campus.
It's like 20,000 people or something.
Oh, even that's just undergrads.
Yeah, it's like a small city.
So, yeah, you see new people literally every day. And one more thing about this, Renner's insinuated from an email that she sent him, trying to be nice, in my opinion, because she said something to the effect of, I know you want me to remember the names of the people at the party, and I just don't remember, and they asked me then, and I couldn't remember, and I can't remember now, and I also never saw most of them again.
Interesting.
And so he calls that statement hinky, because she says some of them again. And then he asks the question, well, who did she see again? What about Sarah? Maybe she saw Sarah again on campus because they lived in the same residential area.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine she probably did run by her every so often in the dining hall or on the road. So he makes it sound so mysterious as if it was like a Freudian slip of some kind. I don't think people generally make highly incriminating Freudian slips.
Yeah.
In emails, in written communication. Maybe sometimes, but generally not.
No.
It probably had a very logical explanation. And so he proceeded to, I don't know of a better way to say this, other than what I think is true, which is essentially call her a liar in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And almost implicate her in Maura's disappearance in his book.
I mean, that's a pretty severe allegation to make against somebody.
It really is.
It's very serious.
And not only that, but he dredged up information about her family, which I assume was extremely painful to read, splattered all over the internet, and that was completely irrelevant to the case. So it might not even be about her or about the case. Like, if she truly believes that she has nothing to offer,
mm-hmm.
I can see why she might not want to put her family through that.
Yeah, it's already happened once.
Right.
She knows the drill. She knows what to expect now from people investigating.
Yeah. As forceful of a statement as this might sound, I think that it's true that Renner burned that bridge.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that the way the show has approached things, they were able to talk to the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did things the right way. So maybe they do talk to Kate later.
Possibly. And so I don't want to be completely unfair.
Yeah.
But the way that they framed it, at least in this one episode, it didn't seem entirely fair because they didn't mention the fact that she already had spoken.
I'm going to be very charitable to the show here and suspect that they were presenting Renner's theory and they wanted mm-hmm. to present it for the purposes of the arc of that episode as, oh, this is, maybe there's something to this.
Almost from his perspective or something.
Yeah,
like,
or from the perspective of the people who buy into that.
Right.
Here's a question. What about Sarah?
What about her?
It was her party. Did he ask her?
Well, first of all, he tried to get in touch with her and she was not interested in talking to him. So he then shows up at her door in Boston and he's from Ohio. That's not exactly something that you expect. And so she, according to him, seemed frightened.
And he probably thought that was suspicious, right?
Yeah.
That a young woman was frightened when he showed up, when he drove out from Ohio to see her. And she already said she didn't want to talk to him.
Right. So he said, I believe the exact words in the book are, Sarah was afraid of something.
I can't put my finger on it. What is she so afraid of? It's almost like she was afraid for her life at that very moment.
Yeah. I guess anything other than inviting a strange man who you've already said you have no interest in speaking to, any action other than inviting him into your home, which perhaps you are alone at home, and divulging every thing that he asks for and answering every single one of his questions would be weird to Renner. He doesn't understand why a woman might not want to invite a strange man into her home.
I wouldn't invite him in. You don't have to be a woman to be to be creeped out. Like, it's, that's the thing. Like, I think probably for him, he's just suspicious that she won't talk to him. So he's already, his radar is already up. Like, why won't she talk to me? Mm-hmm. Why won't she talk to me? I don't get it. I don't get why she wouldn't talk to me. And then I show up at her house and she's scared. Why is she scared? Nothing adds up. None of this makes any sense. You know, like, if you're already not understanding why someone won't talk to you, then you're just, you're gonna go down all the wrong paths.
Yeah. If you've already come to a conclusion and you're just looking for evidence to support that conclusion, of course you're gonna assume that it's because there's, like, a broader conspiracy.
I remember reading comments on his blog about this. Mm-hmm. And people are just like, I have a hard time believing that. Like, nobody knows who's at this party. Like, nobody can remember who was at this party. And it's so funny now that you've gone through the details. And it's like, no, it's like literally one person who probably didn't know anyone there, doesn't remember. And the only other person that we know who was there other than Maura hasn't said a word and probably does know who was at the party. And she has no obligation to talk to anyone other than the police, which she presumably did.
Right.
And we have no information on what she told the police. So there's nothing to go on. For all we know, the police know exactly, they talked to her and they know exactly who was there.
I actually think that's probably the case. They probably do know who was there.
And it's probably irrelevant.
It's more than likely irrelevant, yeah. And if that is the case, if they did speak to individuals that were at the party, we would have no way of knowing that.
And it's funny, though. I will say, when first coming to this, I was confused. I was like, why is all this information unknown? There's all these questions that seem like common sense questions that should be very easy to answer. Mm-hmm. Why are there no answers? But if you look at the process, it's like, how would you find out who was at that party? You'd have to talk to people who've already been scared underground. So
yeah, the other person who I'm not completely sure they're being 100% fair to is Bill Rausch, because similarly, they receive this information from Renner. Mm-hmm. And they do make a point to reach out to him. And again, it appears that he doesn't respond to their inquiries to confirm or deny the allegations that Renner's put out. But Bill is more than capable of defending himself. He doesn't need me to do it for him. But at the same time, it's really unfair, I think, to, again, assume that a refusal to speak to the media should be construed as inherent guilt of the allegations that he's being accused of.
I will say that they do say, Art says on the program, you know, well, there's a lot of stuff. We have to corroborate this.
He
brings up that, like, it is not corroborated. You know, it,
true.
They don't specifically make the point, you know, that, you know, well, this is all hearsay. We shouldn't really consider this. But I think hopefully they lead the viewer to draw that conclusion.
Yeah.
That we can't really put any weight on it. Again, it might be a point that they revisit later in the show, and that might be why they leave it unaddressed. It's hard to say with the show, you know, being in progress at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fairness, that is true.
So, but it's definitely worth pointing out.
And I guess while we're talking about Bill anyway, maybe it is worth pointing out that you could ask, well, what motivation would Renner have to, let's say, exaggerate this claim or say that he lost his job or was fired from his job, when really the only thing that we know is that at some point after the supposed incident occurred, he left his job. So what motivation would Renner have to bring this up? One possibility is that in August of 2015, he went on the Missing Maura Murray podcast and argued that Maura's motivation, or part of the reasoning why she left, was because she was a sociopath.
I think Maura Murray was a sociopath. I think Maura Murray was at her best when she was with Billy Rausch. And I think maybe there was a part of her that was trying to change and trying to strive to be a better person. And Billy certainly brought that person out.
And there was like a collective record screech, I think, you know, among all the listeners of Tim and Lance's podcast, because it was just such an outrageous statement.
Yeah.
And then he, a couple of weeks later, maybe like a month later or so, he went on their podcast again and doubled down.
Wow.
And said, of course she was a sociopath. That's a direct quote.
A lot of people really focused on that sociopath comment from a couple weeks ago.
I get into it a little bit more in the book, of course, you know, but I stick by it. So, yeah, she was a sociopath. Of course she was.
What? What?
Yeah.
That's insane.
I mean, and he got slapped for it. So, you know, the more that people heard that, the more, I think, criticism of that particular statement started to flow in.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, that's not a palatable explanation for why someone would just up and leave and not care about their family,
mm-hmm.
not care about the implications that it's going to have on everyone else.
Right.
If that's not it, then what is it? He had to come up with some, this is just one theory, he had to come up with some explanation
mm-hmm.
for why she'd be so compelled to leave her life.
Right, he had to replace it with something else.
Perhaps. In just several short weeks following those statements, wouldn't you know?
Something comes along.
Something comes along, and now you have an acceptable, palatable reason why she would have been fearful.
Yes, and not just acceptable and palatable, but also kind of scandalous and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so than the idea that she was just upset after wrecking her dad's car and, you know, having to leave West Point and perhaps some family drama. That's kind of boring. But what if her boyfriend was a scumbag who got chased out of a job? Well, that's much more interesting.
And then add on top of that speculation that she was pregnant.
Yep.
Yeah, that is. Oh, that's quite scandalous.
It's more like a soap opera.
Yes. But in my opinion, timing is everything. And the timing of it is just a little suspect for me. His opinions on Bill changed rapidly. I mean,
really?
in August and September of that year, of 2015, he was like, Bill was a great guy. Yeah, I've talked to him. He's a stand-up guy, and his family is a good family. He, like, can't say the better things. And Maura was the bad person, was the sociopath leeching on to this great guy.
Wow.
And that wasn't too long before the book came out. The book came out in May of 2016.
Okay.
So he would have had to have been finishing up the book at that point. Like, he was probably in the final stages of finalizing the book. He says this thing about her being a sociopath, realizes that this is not going to fly,
mm-hmm.
and was probably scrambling to, you know, find an alternative explanation before the manuscript initial draft submission was due.
Right.
So yeah, the timing there is just way suspicious. And just because if you think she's a sociopath on Monday and you have all these reasons to believe that she's a sociopath,
mm-hmm.
and then you find out an additional piece of information about somebody else on Tuesday, that doesn't erase everything that you learned about the first individual on Monday.
Why does your theory that she's a sociopath just go away? Unless you're mentally replacing one with the other.
Which is exactly what he did, because logically, they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
You can be a sociopath and also have a boyfriend who's a jerk.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely. So, if his evidence that she's a sociopath is any good, he shouldn't have dropped it.
Right.
But it's a rip and replace. It's like there's a chapter in the book that he had to fill in or something. Not that I'm saying that's what happened, but it could be.
That's what I'm saying happened.
Well.
I think that's exactly what happened.
We don't have any evidence as what happened, but it certainly fits.
True. We do not have evidence.
What's good for the goose is good for the gander, I would say, in this case, Mr. Renner. You don't want people speculating about your process of crafting the book. Well, perhaps you should be a little more careful in throwing accusations around.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. I'm just looking at a blog post, one of Renner's blog posts. I don't know if you've probably run into that theory. Well, it's nothing even remotely new. I mean, look at all those authors who write about UFOs and alien abductions and stuff and feed people's belief that, you know, disappearances or horrible things were caused by aliens and the government's covering up and all this stuff. You know, insane things. They make tons of money doing it. This is only slightly more legitimate than that because he doesn't actually mention aliens, I assume. But, like, he's, like, in that
no,
wheelhouse.
He does.
What?
Not exactly aliens. In the book, he believes that his son is psychic. He believes his son can read people's thoughts.
Oh. Well, that makes a lot of sense now. He's a crackpot.
And he has this one story about how a friend of his swears that he saw a kid in those, like, old newsboy outfits from, like, the 20s.
Uh-huh. Like a newsie?
Like extra kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Swears that he saw him appear and then, like, disappear. So, essentially, he was talking about some, like, wormhole concept. And this was in the context of going to New Hampshire the first time. Like, what did he think he was going to find? And then he starts talking about how these things have happened where people just appear and disappear. Like, what? He's a great fiction writer. I'll say that.
That's madness. Or she was going to Canada to build a new life. That or a wormhole. Those are my best theories.
Yeah.
Facts, evidence, pretty sure wormhole or Canada. Something as bizarre and sci-fi-y as aliens. Wormhole. That's a new one. I've not heard that theory before. I've heard other crazy things about the disappearance of, like, ships and planes. There's a theory in Lyme, Connecticut, that Lyme disease, which is named for Lyme, Connecticut, comes from a top-secret government facility, which actually exists or existed on an island off the coast of Connecticut. And
Plum Island?
What?
Plum Island.
Yeah, Plum Island. Oh, you're aware of it.
Very, actually. So continue your story.
The idea that Lyme disease was a government-created disease that escaped on deer because deer were known to cross regularly between the mainland and Plum Island, and it's spread by deer ticks.
That's not that crazy.
Yeah. Of the crazy theories, that one's actually like, I'm like, yeah, that's very possible that happened. Now, of course, it's not a very effective biological weapon because it takes like years to kill people and it doesn't really kill them.
It's
that
pretty
well.
Lame.
Yeah. You know.
It's like, you made me tired.
Well, when the Soviets are exhausted, that's when we'll strike and, you know, defeat them.
Although I don't know how well they fare in like sub-zero temperatures.
There's deer in Siberia, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if they're enough people.
Yeah.
But yeah, a friend of mine worked on Plum Island for Department of Homeland Security, and I went to visit him in Old Saybrook.
Yep.
So I like hung out with DHS people, and they were hammered and joking about how crazy it was on Plum Island because that they had to walk onto the island and like immediately take a shower, and just the weird farm animals that were there. And like, uh-huh. So I don't think it's so outside the realm of possibility. Yeah.
Certainly not.
And also, that story reminded me that people never really grow up because there's this one, I guess, like, really awkward scientist who really, he did not want to be naked in front of anyone.
Okay.
And had a really hard time with that. And, like, you have to be at some point.
Right, in the shower, yeah.
And they stole his clothes out of his locker. It's like, you are literally, like, that's a high school prank.
Yep.
But I found it so funny because like, they're like old.
Yep.
I hope he like poisoned them with deer ticks.
Ha ha, you have Lyme disease now.
I forgot how we started this tangent.
We were talking about Renner, backtracking to theories about Canada.